People here who are not parents. I see people here who are great-grandparents. I hope that you appreciate the irony. How many of you have raised children? How many of us have not? Here's the irony right here. Okay, there are three of us. You have the handouts. I'm going to encourage you to take notes, and here's why. How much do you remember of what you hear? 15%. 15% of what you hear and see jumps up to about 40. Now, it's our hope that next week you will come back and have conversations based on your own experience, what you're hearing here, and sharing wisdom with one another. Because when you hear, see, and then engage with it, it jumps up to 85 to 90. Okay? So we actually have a strategy for how we're doing this. All right? 85 to 90% for what you hear, see, and then engage with in some kind of conversation. So that's why we're alternating back and forth between talking, maybe a little seeing, and then conversing. All right? So, we have some problems that we just want to be honest about right up front. How many of you were trained to be parents? We actually do have one. How did they train you? Oh, so government agency actually had a little bit of training for you. Okay. How many of you were trained by the government? Do they do better with parental training than they do with other things? Okay. We don't have training, and that can be either good or bad. There are good parents whose children resent the oversight, and there are bad parents whose abusive patterns are picked up by their offsprings. You know, so it's hard to know whether training would be any good either way in that regards. Secondly, children, they don't come with instructions. You know, we have no shortage of experts. My mom, in her years, the expert was Spock, Dr. Spock, you know, and how much of what he says are people still operating out of? You know, there's all kinds of questions about, you know, what he suggested. So yesterday's experts they're ridiculed today. And today's wisdom, you can expect by the time your children are having children, will be equally, you know, discardable, okay? So, then, what you do that works really, really well with one child doesn't work with the next child, you know? We are so incredibly, wonderfully, beautifully complex, even as children, that our keenest insights and the things that we do learn from the one, this child here needs something completely different, you know? So, then we look at the reality that the world is changing so fast that it is almost impossible for us to have a clue about how the technologies that are now available to our children, and they are better at that technology than we are, is going to impact them, you know? So we have to make the best educated guesses that we can in an incredibly complex and rapidly changing world. So there are a number of things that are set against us, either those of you who are actually in the parenting and those of you who are in the grandparenting, because I see some of both here. And then we have a fifth complication. You can do absolutely everything right and there'll still be problems, you know? Our children are like us. May I see the hand of the perfect adult? You know? And you can do absolutely everything right, and a child can still have the option of using the freedom that they have received from the Lord their God to choose no to whatever it is that we have planned for them. Okay, so we've got a number of things that are against us, and we want to be honest about those. And then we have our own little limitations in terms of tonight. And the first is that I am not a family, child, parenting, marriage, or elder expert. Let's be honest. I'm a Catholic priest, which means I do know priests who have had children. Priests who, before they became priests, married, had children, had families. Children grew up, became widowers, who then went to the seminary. And now they're in a different situation than I. I went in at 16 to the seminary and went all the way through. So I'm not one of those. What I am is a biblical scholar. And what I would like to talk about is the scriptural perspective on things. All right, so that we can get to the heart of the values that are at play. But if we're going to talk about the scriptures, we have a second real problem. The scriptures could not have conceived of our world. They couldn't have conceived of our world. The room that we're sitting in is beyond the comprehension of the ancient world. That there could be an expanse with a flat ceiling like this, with no pillars to hold up the center of the room, they'd feel panic sitting in this room because they'd just know that that's coming down at any point. And these lights, what are those? These mystical apparitions of light in the ceiling, you know, let alone the pictures that change over here. They couldn't possibly have entered into our world. And their concept of family is going to be different than ours. Their world was very clearly patriarchal. The man was in charge. The woman had charge of the little children. The man had charge of the sons and their training in whatever the trade of the family was when they reached an age when they were, that was appropriate. His only interest in his daughters was making arrangements for their marriage, and that was entirely in his hands. In the Jewish culture, right up until they were 14, at 14, if they reached the age of 14 and had not been married by that point, they had right of refusal, but they didn't have right of choice. Okay? At 13, they had no choice. At 14, they could say no. They couldn't say him. Okay? So right off the bat, when they're talking about family, their thoughts are very different than our thoughts. Sons would marry very young, bringing their wives into their father's household. So what you'd have is this, more or less a family compound. There'd be dad. Dad would be ancient. He'd be in his 30s. Okay? And he would have started having children himself when he was 13, yeah. And the reason why they did this was because by the time you were in your 20s, you were already beginning to develop enough sicknesses that your ability to pass on your genes and to successfully carry children to adulthood was already beginning to narrow very rapidly, especially for the women. Okay, as soon as you were able to bear children, you did. So they married their daughters as soon as they reached menarche, as soon as they began to menstruate, they would marry them. And to a boy of a roughly parallel age, now that's terribly young, but they would live in the household of the father. And the father would govern the life of his son, even though he was married, and the mother would govern the daughter-in-law's life, okay? So you had these very tight clusters with fathers and perhaps multiple sons and their wives who were incredibly young living in households together. Does that resemble our lives at all? No, no. So can you see how in that world it would be critically important that a 13, 14, 15, 16-year-old father have an incredible amount of respect for his father in turn, because he's not actually old enough to negotiate life on his own. And the very strong advice about how fathers and sons are supposed to relate to one another all the way through life becomes critically important, all right? So, now, they could not conceive of our situation. For us, here in the United States, who runs the household? You do? Yay! is it so clear? No. It's a negotiation, isn't it? It's a negotiation. Now, right next door, it's one of the things we have to teach our seminarians. A fair number of our seminarians grew up here, and they understand this, but we have a number who come from Mexico, who come from Vietnam, who come from Korea, and in those circumstances, who runs the house? Yeah. Yeah. Do you see how important it is for us to negotiate with them, how this doesn't work here the way it does there? You know. Okay. Scripturally speaking, they did not conceive of a very common thing in our society, which is single-parent households. And they're very normal with us. We have a number of single-parent households where mothers, most frequently, and on occasion fathers, are rearing children by themselves, you know, heroically, you know, making things work. We have not uncommonly blended families. That was not unknown to them, but it's very common now, where either through divorce and remarriage or widowing early enough where husbands and wives who've had children from other partners marry and bring children together into a blended situation, that wouldn't have been completely unfamiliar to them. It is much more common now. We have grandparents who are raising grandchildren, don't we? Do we have any grandparents raising children here? Nobody here. Okay. That also would not have been unheard of in their circumstance because death was so easy in their world. People very readily died all the way through at every age because their inability to respond medically speaking. All right, so that's not so familiar, unfamiliar to them. The adoption situation is so much more similar in our, it's so much more common in our world than it would have been in theirs. And we have families with adult children who are at home, and I'm not talking about 16, 17, and 18-year-olds. I'm talking about 30, 34. I had, just last week, a woman telling me about her 51-year-old son who was a live-at-home son, you know. And we have something relatively new, intentional families, people who are not married to one another, who have no intention of being married to one another, who are not actually even sexually engaged with one another, but who view each other in an intentional sense as family, you know. This is something relatively new. So we've got a lot of creative things that the scriptures would not have dealt with because they weren't conceived of at the time. So when we start the whole question, I think the best place to start is in terms of our own relationships to God, with God. If we're going to really be people of faith, not people who talk about faith, but people who have a faith and act that faith out. If we're going to be that, we're going to have to allow God's word shed light upon what we do. So please repeat after me. Everyone's life needs to be evangelized, including mine. And what I mean by evangelized, when we find that our values, and that's the bedrock, or our actions are in conflict with the scriptures, the one that needs to change is me. Yeah. If we're going to actually be people of faith, if we're going to actually trust that the Scriptures are the Word of God. Now, recognizing the differences between their world and ours, what we're going to be hunting for are the values that we need to be looking at seriously. Not necessarily replicating their culture. We don't have to become Jews of the first century. We don't have to become Greeks of the first century. What we have to do is recognize their values and ask, how do we take their values, the values that they received from God the Father, and apply it in their world, and take those very same values and apply them in ours? Okay, so that's what we're going to be trying to do. And the starting point is God, specifically God's will, God's values. And the one thing that we are certain of, what does God will for you? What does God will for you? Happiness, goodness, health. God wills every good thing for you. So when God teaches, what are his goals in teaching you? Your happiness, your wholeness, your health. Okay? Now, it is not ever God's intent to throw roadblocks in your way, except that roadblock prevents you from harming yourself or others. Okay? And that has to be our starting point. If we do not trust that God is actively seeking out our good, then nothing we have to say here is going to be helpful. That has to be a conviction that we carry. All right? So, he wills nothing contrary to our welfare. I'm going to read to you from Galatians 4:4. When the fullness of time had come, God sent his Son, born of a woman, born under the law, to ransom those under the law so that we might receive adoption as proof that you are children. God sent the Spirit of his Son into our hearts, crying out, Abba, Father. So you are no longer a slave, but a child. And if a child, then also an heir through God. Everything that you want for your child, every good thing that you want for your child, God wants for you because you are God's child. And he uses this metaphor from our lives so that we can understand how intimately close he experiences us. Starting point for you is that, and you may be 80 years old, and you are still God's child. And you may have, on human terms, incredible wisdom, but contrasting that wisdom with God's, you remain God's child. And there's no shame in that. In fact, all there is affection, love, and commitment. That's what he has for you. So let's consider God's parenting. Let's look at the way he does things. And in particular, what we want to reflect is how he deals with his own son. So looking at those patterns, reading Mark's Gospel, chapter 1, verse 9. It happened in those days that Jesus came from Nazareth of Galilee and was baptized in the Jordan by John. On coming up out of the water, he saw the heavens being torn open and the Spirit like a dove descending on him. And a voice came from the heavens, "You are my beloved Son. With you, I am well pleased." Now, this is Mark's Gospel, and this is the first place. It's chapter 1. It's the first place where Jesus actually appears in Mark's Gospel. In Matthew's Gospel and Luke's Gospel, we have infancy narratives, but this is Mark's Gospel. No infancy narrative. This is where Jesus appears. And please notice that the heavens being opened, the dove descending, the voice speaking, it's all from the perspective of Jesus. Jesus is the one who's noticing all this. So this isn't being done for the crowd. This isn't being done to edify John the Baptist. We don't know if anyone else knows that this happens. I'm going to reread it. So notice who everything is happening for. On coming up out of the waters, he, Jesus, saw the heavens being torn open and the Spirit like a dove descending on him. And a voice came from the heavens, "You are my beloved Son." Not, "He is my beloved Son," but "You are my beloved Son. With you I am well pleased." So he sees the dove descending. He hears the voice telling him he is beloved. He hears the Father telling him that the Father is pleased. Why? Why would this happen? To give him confidence. Who said it? Affirmation. Do you think Jesus needed affirmation? Yeah. Yeah, I think that is exactly right. Here is God the Father speaking to God the Son, fully human, recognizing that if Jesus is fully human, that he needs affirmation. Now, here's one of those moments where I've asked groups of women in the past, when do men know who they are? Yeah, the women giggle just like that. And when I push them to ask, when does it happen? At what age do men actually know who they are? The answer is, they never do. Yeah, all right. I'd like to suggest that we're not that bad off. Women do come to a sense of themselves sooner than men do. That's absolutely certain. Some women have a very good sense of it in their late teens, but not very many. Most of them somewhere in their 20s. Men, mid-20s, late-20s, 30s, sometimes 40s, you know, just to be honest. And everyone's a little different, and there's no one thing that everyone does. What I'd like to suggest is that this is that very moment when Jesus really, it all comes together for him. And it's not that this is the first time he recognizes that he is the Son of the Father. In Luke's Gospel, we have a story that we'll get to a little bit later this evening, where he seems to have an awareness that he and the Father, God the Father, have a special relationship. But here's where it all comes together for him. Where this thing that he has been growing ever more certain of, he hears God say to him, "Yes, you are my beloved Son." This thing that has been growing in your mind and in your heart from the beginning, it's true. You are my beloved Son. And you've been wondering, am I pleased with you? And yes, I am well pleased with you. Now, we have the person who I expect would be the ideal son, fully, incredibly, amazingly competent and intelligent and gifted and charismatic, such that he can walk along a seashore and summon people to follow him, and they drop their lives, and they do, because there's something incredibly powerful about him that's going to happen. That's the very next thing that's going to happen in this gospel. This person with all of these incredible gifts needs to be affirmed. Yeah. And the Father, who knows this about the Son, with delight affirms him. Do our children need affirmation? Oh. Now, that's different than telling our children that they're special. What's the problem with telling our children that they're special? A big ego, yeah. We really do have a problem there. Do you ever listen to Garrison Keillor's Prairie Hometown Companion, where all the women are strong and the men are good-looking and all of the children are above average? If all of the children are above average, then there's no average. The average needs to be, average is 50% or below and 50% or above. If they're all above average, then the average needs to, the whole business of special is you're better than somebody else. So now affirmation does not mean convincing our children that they're special and that they're better than or that they are more valuable than. All right? So we're not saying special. We're saying good. We're affirming the real gifts that they have. And they don't have to be better than someone else. They don't have to be more talented than someone else. All we have to do is recognize that, in fact, they are talented. That there are things that they do very well. And that there is a tremendous goodness in them. And whenever they do things that demonstrate that goodness, to point it out and to celebrate that goodness. Not because they're better than those kids over there, but because in and of themselves, they are good. And it makes sense that they are good. In whose image and likeness are they created? Yeah. So, now they do start off pagans. All of our babies, they start off all about themselves, do they not? You know, they're hungry. Wow. They feel uncomfortable down south. Wow. You know, they start off little pagans. They're all about themselves. And we have got to not simply wean them from mother's milk, but we've got to wean them from their entire focus on the self. And it really is a process of taking them from total, complete self-preoccupation such that they can actually be nice to their siblings, if they have any. I was one of nine, and my mom was heroic. I know I preached on this once. I was always a big child, and she had me convinced that the world was going to come to an end if I ever laid my hands on any one of those others. Even my older sisters were smaller than I was, and. But that wasn't what she was hoping for. She was hoping for, after the fear of damage was passed, that I might actually take care of, that I might defend, that I might be a good example to, that I might be sweet to, that I might be nurturing with, that I might be, a little older, a little bit of good advice, a good companionship, a little bit of security in an insecure world. That's what she was hoping for, okay? Now, you don't start off that way at 5 and 6. No, someone has to insist on this behavior all the way through. And someone has to believe that I'm able to accomplish that, don't they? You know, it's not simply that they believe that I will fear them enough not to, go after. All right. So, it begins with not God saying, "You are my better than any other son." That's not what he says. Was Jesus better than any of other sons? Please say yes. Just say yes, Father. Okay, all right. Yes, Jesus was better than any of us. God the Father could have said, "You are my best son of all." He didn't say that. He didn't say, "I am more pleased with you than I am with anyone else." Okay, please notice what he did not say. He said the truth, he said it simply, he said it succinctly, and the whole thing was that you are valuable, not better than, but valuable. You are my beloved son, and with you, I am well pleased. It's intimate, it's relational, it's true, and God was pleased. Okay, so now that doesn't mean from Mary and Joseph's perspective that everything was smooth. What do you think that the baby Jesus did when he was uncomfortable down south? Yeah, I have to believe it. I have to believe that he was just as loud. He was probably, was the baby Jesus colicky? Was he quick to sleep long hours at night? You know, we want to think the best of the baby Jesus. But I note, we only have one story of him as an adolescent. We only have one. And it's an interesting story, and it reveals to us something about even the best possible child with whom God is very well pleased. Okay? So let's take a look at it. It's in Luke chapter 2, verse 40. And look how this story starts. The child grew, so he doesn't start an adult, became strong, and became filled with wisdom on a child's level, became filled with wisdom, and the favor of God was upon him. All right, so first of all, we are not imagining a little baby in Mary's arms contemplating nuclear physics. What was the baby thinking? The baby Jesus was thinking, milk. Milk would be very good about now, you know. Hold me, smile at me, cuddle me. You know, those are what's going on. But as he grows, he's apparently quick to understand the world around him, quick to understand the world around him. But he needed someone to teach him how to dress himself. How about that? God incarnate needed someone to teach him how to dress himself. I don't know what potty training the Son of the Father was like. I'm hoping he was cooperative. Did he have the inclination? Did he have the temptation to do wrong? Hebrews 4:15 suggests the answer to that question is yes, what it says. Speaking about Jesus as an adult, we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weakness, but one, referring to Jesus, who has similarly been tested in every way, but without sin. So he had all of the temptations that all of our children, that we ourselves, over the course of the years of our lives, have confronted. He simply never said yes to those temptations, okay? So, as a child, was he tempted to temper tantrums? Probably. Was he frightened by strangers? Probably. Was he inclined to imitate everything that Joseph did? Probably. Did he put everything in his mouth at the appropriate age? Probably, yeah. Did he want to help? You know, probably. Yeah, he did all of this without sin. So are you comfortable with that portrayal of Jesus? If we don't say this, we're not really taking the humanity of Jesus seriously. And as Catholics, as Christians, we believe that Jesus Christ is fully God and fully human. Now, there is far more to the second person of the Trinity that can fit into a human person. I don't know where that part of him was, and I cannot explain it to you. It's one of those things when we're dealing with God, God is going to do things that are beyond our ability to explain. So I'm going to just admit to you, I cannot explain where the fullness of divinity was at that moment, but if he is fully human then, he has to learn to tie his shoes, so to speak, fix the straps on his sandals, whatever it was. Could Jesus have jealous feelings and not act on them? Could he have anger and not act? Could he have insecurity and not act? Could he have fear and not act? Could he take every human emotion and say yes? Could it be a fault? We see, here is where we have troubles because we haven't thought things through. Our feelings are never sin. Our feelings are never sin. Our chosen behaviors can be. For something to be sin, we have to recognize that it is wrong and choose it. Have any of you ever chosen your feelings? No, they're spontaneous and they're outside our grasp. And so he can have the full range of human emotions, some of which, had he acted upon, would probably have been detrimental. Had he known that it was detrimental, he didn't act on them. Now the question is, did he always know? And so we're going to carry on with this story. So, the child grew, became strong, filled with wisdom. Verse 41, each year the parents went up to Jerusalem for the feast of Passover. And when he was 12, they went up according to festival custom. After they had completed its days, as they were returning, the boy Jesus remained behind in Jerusalem, but the parents did not know this. And you're asking yourself, how could they possibly not have known? You know, what were they thinking? All right, how old is he? And what is that in the life of a Jewish boy? You know, he's right on that breaking point. Prior to this, he is under the care of his mother. Yeah. And what is Mary thinking? Jesus isn't with him. Excuse me, Jesus isn't with her. He's with Dad. And it's probably a little bit emotional for him. For her. It's probably a little bit emotional for her because what is she thinking? He's not mine anymore. And it's one of those torn things. He's growing up and he's ready and I'm proud of him and I miss him already. You know that terrible twisty thing that you go through as your children mature. Now what is Joseph thinking? The kid's with mom. All right. We have that incredibly ironic moment from our perspective in the bar mitzvah, done when a child in our world, bar mitzvah for the boys, bat mitzvah for the girls, when they read from the Torah, and what do they say? Now I am a man. And you've got this 13-year-old kid seeing this, you know. Well, that's apparently what's happened here. Mary thinks she's lost him and he's now in the care of Joseph. Joseph is thinking he's with Mary. He's not 13 yet. He's not he's not ready for the guy thing. And so they find, and it would not at all have been uncommon for women and the children to have been in a caravan situation together and the men busy off doing manly things, at another end of the same caravan. Not at all unfamiliar. Now, what's Jesus doing? Is he doing the right thing? He should have told his parents what he's going to do. Let's just follow along. Verse 44. Thinking that he was in the caravan, they journeyed for a day and looked for him among their relatives and acquaintances, because they still can't believe that he is not with them. They cannot believe that he is not with them. Why can't they believe this? Because he's a good kid, you know? He does what he is told. You know, he's obedient to them. So they fully expect that he's going to be with them. And so they go on for yet another day thinking they're going to find him somewhere in this crowd. But not finding him, now this is 2 days out. They journeyed 2 days back. We are now 4 days removed from this little boy, this big boy. Not finding him, they returned to Jerusalem to look for him. After 3 days, they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. And all who heard him were astounded at his understanding and his answers. So part of their befuddlement is he really does understand the world extraordinarily well in ways that baffled the other adults around them, and probably Joseph and Mary also. So it is hard for them to understand why is it that he is doing what he is doing. Okay? Because they fully expect that the child Jesus, the perfect child, is going to do the right thing. Now, does this perfect child think that he is doing the right thing? Yes, he does. When his parents saw him, they were astonished, and his mother said to him, "Son, why have you done this to us? Your father and I have been looking for you with great anxiety." And he said to them, "Why were you looking for me? Didn't you know that I must be in my father's house?" Did he think he was doing the right thing? Was he? No. He was not. This was not the right thing. This was not the right thing. Did he know that it was the wrong thing? No, and see, and there you have it. And here is part of the complexity of child rearing. The perfect child with extraordinarily keen insight who bedazzles the learned people in his midst does not know what the right thing is. Jesus doesn't end up in the care of Mary and Joseph by accident. He is in their care because he needs them. What 12-year-old understands the dangers of the world? They don't. Do we want them to? Not yet, you know. We don't want them to know yet. Mary and Joseph have apparently sheltered him more than he is aware of, because he thinks that it's okay for him to be about what he understands at this point. He does understand already. He's got something special going on with the father, and he's about this important thing. With all of the enthusiasm and misguided sensibilities of an adolescent. This is the perfect one who does this and leads his mother to ask, "Why did you do this to us?" Did he understand the impact of what he did on these people that he's loves, that he's fond of, that he's deeply faithful to? No. And see, there it is, right there. I have a sister who is a child guidance counselor for the school system of El Segundo. And she has three children. And while they were infants, she went to work at the school system. As soon as the first one of them reached fourth grade, what did she do? She quit working and she went home. Now, this is the reverse of what people typically do. Typically, people are at home when their children are small, and then as soon as they reach an age where they're more or less able to take care of themselves, then they go back to work. And her reasoning was, the studies demonstrate with some consistency that the lifetime problems that our children get into begin at fourth, fifth, sixth grade. And if there is ever a point in their life that they need parents to be home, that's when it is. They don't start lifelong problems in the second grade. They don't initiate things that are going to dog them through life in the third grade. Some are precocious, and it will be in the fourth. More likely, it will be in the fifth. And almost everyone's into something by the time they're in the sixth, okay? And it's part, you pointed out, they're establishing, you know, a certain, they're beginning to establish their distinction from you, and that's a healthy thing. It's not a bad thing, but they need you to guide them through that moment as they discover who they are and what their new capacities are, which are growing incredibly every year. And they do need to have a sense of self and independence, otherwise they're going to be clinging to you when they're 51, and that is its own problem. Okay. So we want them to do this, but the perfect one doesn't understand the dangers of the world, doesn't understand yet the emotional life of his parents. Why did you do this to us, is Mary's question. He doesn't answer the question. Why didn't you understand, Mom? I had to do this. You didn't tell us? You didn't suggest to us that this was something that you thought was right about now? You know, you didn't know that your dad and I would be a train wreck for 4 days. You didn't understand this. And he didn't. The perfect child did not understand this. None of us were perfect children, and none of us will have them. Mary had the best odds. All right? So, they don't understand, and we have to protect them. They do not understand the terrible dangers of the world. We do not want them to yet understand that. We don't want them to live in fear. We don't want them, you know, to be crippled. Emotionally speaking, we don't want them to not be able to venture forth. And we have to have a trusting enough relationship with them that they can begin to negotiate this thing with us. But it has to be with us. The young boy Jesus needed Mary and Joseph. So, they did not understand what he said to him. Yeah. For all of his apparent brilliance, he was still a boy and needed parental guidance. Verse 51. He went down with them from Jerusalem to Nazareth. Jerusalem's up high, down to Nazareth. He went down with them and came to Nazareth and was obedient to them. You see, that's what you're not going to get your adolescents to do. All right. And was obedient to them, and his mother kept all these things in her heart. And Jesus advanced in wisdom and age and favor before God and before people. Okay, so listen, please, everybody breathe in a nice cleansing breath and let it go. If Joseph and Mary had troubles with Jesus, feel better about yourselves. Okay, all right. And here's the critical thing. How do people learn? How do children learn? How does anyone learn? Yeah. The wise person learns from other people's mistakes. All right. Are children wise? No. Why do children follow what you tell them to do? They're afraid of the consequences. That's exactly right, and that is age appropriate. They are afraid of being punished, and they have learned if you say this and you and they do that, that there's punishment waiting for them. And you know, there's one of my mom's greatest triumphs. She had 9 kids, and she never gave a threat that she didn't carry it through. You know, there was a real consistency there. We knew if she said it, she meant it. There was room for extenuating circumstances, but they had better be passed along very quickly because the threatened demolition was coming your way. All right. Most people are not wise. The wise person does, in fact, learn from someone else's mistake, but most people are not wise. Most people learn from their own mistakes. Okay? That's the truth. The fool simply never learns. All right, so there we have. There's the breakdown of things. The wise person learns from other people's mistakes. The normal person learns from their own mistakes. The fool never learns. All right, now at this age, an adolescent can't possibly be wise. Now you're going to structure things to the best of your ability, that your wisdom, that the mistakes that you have made and learned from are going to take place in their life by instituting structure and guidance and clear consequences such that, they know that when they venture forth in the wrong direction, things are going to happen. But Jesus here has to grow in wisdom and understanding because no one starts off with it. You only get wisdom from having fallen to your knees, skinned those knees, and learned the consequences of skipping rope and on ice or whatever. Okay. So, so this brings us to the rearing of our own children. And everything is going to be predicated on the following passage from Matthew. We're jumping to Matthew's Gospel, chapter 7, verse 9. And Jesus is going to ask a question that demonstrates his presumption of your relationship with your children. Yeah. Just to make sure that everyone hears you. I've mentioned two things. One is that at age 13 and 14, you're not ready to assume the responsibilities of an adult, okay? At age 13, you don't necessarily know what to do. You need guidance. Yes, to both of those. What when people lived only into their 30s and 40s, and 40s would have been remarkably old for the peasant, 90% of the people, 90% of the people, 40s, of only a very small portion of the 95% made it into their 40s, only very small. So when did you have that chance? Their world was different enough than ours in this sense. It's not that it never changed, but it changed very slowly. Now, in that kind of stable environment, the culture does figure itself out. People do figure out how to live. They do figure out how relationships work. They pass them on, and the thing that works for the parent, in fact, works for the child. Now, think about your growing up years. How much time did you spend texting? How much time did we spend on the computer? I remember the first TV that my parents... I remember the first TV that my parents had, and it was a small one, it was black and white, and it was fuzzy. I remember picking up the phone and listening for just a second because we had a party line. The idea that I could carry a phone, I mean, that was Star Trek, you know? That you could talk wirelessly with someone, that was science fiction. Do you remember when everyone came, the people who were trying to impress everybody came with those great big huge telephones into the restaurants, you know, and then sat there conspicuously talking with someone, you know? Our world is changing so fast that our capacity by 30 and 40 to figure things out is different than theirs was in a relatively, it's not that it never changed, it's not that things didn't happen that were traumatic, but in a relatively stable environment, they can, in fact, over decades, centuries, and millennia, figure things out and how to pass them on effectively. We can't. We've lost it. And it's not our fault. It's not our fault. It's not something that you're doing wrong. It's that our world is changing so incredibly fast that we have young men who are very much closer in their 30s to adolescence than you would have been at 17 or 18 if you're in your 80s and 70s and 60s. And they're in their 30s, and they're not so much the girls, not so much the women, it's the boys and the men who sit in front of their computer, and their whole life of entertainment is this gaming world with people that they never meet. And it's all of the free hours of the day, and they're in their 30s. Okay? EJ, don't do this. All right, so yes. Yes, they could, by their 30s, have a better angle at their world than we can at ours. Our world began to change rapidly about the year 10, 15, 20, somewhere in there. That's when technology began to supersede our ability to catch up with it. We were more clever than we were wise. We very cleverly are devising things at such an incredibly rapid pace that are so making such radical changes in our lives that we can't keep up with it emotionally or intellectually. The car. In 1900... the speed limit in most cities was 15 miles an hour. On most Sunday afternoons, I drive to Glendale and I have lunch with my mom. You know, she's 82. I'm going to have lunch with her as often as I can. You know, she lives 50 miles away. In 1890, that was a 2.5-day journey. It wouldn't have happened. But I can do that now. It's hard even for us. And that was only 1900 when that really rapidly changed in people's lives. Most people prior to that lived and died within a day's walk of the place where they were born. You know? So they had advantages. They had stability. They had continuity in ways that we don't. All right, so. All right, so Matthew 7:9 is going to use your relationship with your child as a model in terms of our relationship with God. But it's going to say something about what God presumes about your relationship with your child. So Matthew 7, 9 says, which one of you would hand his child a stone when he asks for a loaf of bread? Or a snake or a scorpion, in Luke's gospel, when he asks for a fish? If you then, who are wicked, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your heavenly Father give good things to those who ask him? Now, this is actually talking about God the Father's relationship with him. But the presumption is, which one of you would do something harmful as opposed to helpful for your child? Can you think of, and everyone's answers to this one is going to be a little different, and we're on a sliding scale here. It's going to be different because there are things that actually shape how, in fact, we are acting to our children. There is the stay-at-home parent who is financially comfortable, who is able to give large amounts of time to the welfare of the child at one end. There is the single parent who works long hours, perhaps two jobs, and is only narrowly financially holding it all together, who only gets a short period of time with the child and is exhausted before she ever gets there. Which one loves the child more? I mean, you can't answer that question, can you? You know, but is there going to be a different way of relating to that child between those two situations? Oh, yeah, there has to be. There has to be. There's not a difference in love, but there's going to be a difference in energy. There's going to be a difference in availability. And they're both going to be expending themselves, and one is going to be able to do it more effectively than the other. And it's not going to be fair, and the world is that way. But here he is. He's going to presume that we are going to do the best we can for our children, but the person who is exhausted, can they do their best for their child? What do I hear more often than anything else from parents in the confessional? I'm impatient with my children. I'm impatient with my spouse. Those are far and away the thing that I hear the most. I'm impatient with the person that I love more than anybody else. I'm impatient with the ones who are completely dependent upon me, who thrill me, who are my joy, and I am impatient with them. You know? This is with all of our labor-saving devices and our cars that get us there rapidly. And this is still where our lives are. Now, there is no substitute for your willingness to love your child. There is no substitute for that. And when you are that way, when you are actually loving your child, you are like God. And God actually uses your love for your child as a way of describing what God is like. Because God presumes your love and care for your children. What gets in the way? Well, a number of things. Life does. We can be tired, you know. We can be overworked. Then we become impatient and perhaps shrill. Sometimes our pride gets in the way when we ask our children to live out not their dreams, but ours, yeah. Our pride can get in the way. When they have to fulfill our dreams, you know. I wasn't the athlete that I could have been, but my boy will be. Do our children have dignity in and of themselves? Already. Yeah. Already. They don't have to earn bread from you rather than the stone. They don't have to earn it. They don't have to do something to achieve it. They have a dignity in and of themselves. It's what God says about us. As much as we love our children, God loves us more, and he's not waiting for us to demonstrate our value to him. He loves us completely independent of our accomplishments. And that has to be the starting point for our relationship with our children. They cannot earn what they have an entitlement to from us, that God expects so much so that he will use you as the example to describe him with us. Okay? That's how convinced God is of the value of your children. He just knows that you're going to do the best for them, simply because they, in and of themselves, already have the dignity and the value that's theirs. Now, I'm going to say, besides the things that life does to us that get in the way, and our pride that can get in the way, our human weaknesses get in the way too. Our fragility is going to get in the way. We'll talk a little bit more about that later, but I'll just point that out. That's another one. All right. So we come to the question of obedience. What do the scriptures say? They presume obedience. They presume that a child will ought to honor a parent. Ephesians 6:1 says, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother. This is the first commandment with a promise, that it may go well with you and that you may have a long life on earth. Now, fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up with the training and instruction of the Lord." Colossians 3:20 says something similar, slightly different. It says, "Children, obey your parents in everything, for this is pleasing to the Lord. Fathers, do not provoke your children so that they may not become discouraged." Now, this is a command to children. Implicitly, it is a command to parents. If children are supposed to honor you, what must you be? Honorable, yes. I mean, don't get in the way of your child fulfilling that commandment. All right, the only way really for the child to do that with enthusiasm is when we, in fact, are honorable. All right, we have to honestly be for their benefit. No one, and that's children included, have to blindly obey authorities who are drowning themselves in alcohol, who are selfishly consumed with their own issues, with their own jobs, with their own relationships. No child has to obediently sit in a car while the parent drives that car over a cliff. Does that make sense to you? So, implicit in the command to children to honor and obey their parents is the presumption that parents are honorable, and the things that the children must obey must actively be for their welfare. That makes sense to you? That's one of those commands that's two-edged. It's not simply aimed at the child. It's aimed at all of us. It's aimed at all of us. And honor and obedience will always be earned. And when does the child know it? When they have their own kids. It's absolutely true. they're not going to appreciate you until they've reached until they've moved into that wisdom thing and they can learn from other people's mistakes, okay? It's not until they've had enough life experience, and often enough it is really, in fact, having their own children, that they're going to move into that stage in life that they're going to look back on the things that you said and the things that you instructed and the way that you behaved and recognize the sacrifices that you made and the great efforts that you went to and how hard it was for you to tell someone that you loved no. But they're going to have to do that. They're going to have a child. Yes. My sister Kathy tells a story. She walked into the hallway and was walking by Caitlin's doorway, and Caitlin was, I don't know, two or three. And Caitlin was looking at her doll, her little doll, and she was saying, "No." And she went like this, and she turned around and said, "I told you no." Just like that. And Kathy is telling this, and then she says, "Caitlin was imitating me. I told you no." Did Mom tell Kathy no? When did Kathy understand? Now, actually, Kathy was, of all of the nine of us, Kathy was the one who actually got it as a child. She was extraordinary. The rest of us, we had to be a little older. I mean, but really, it's not until they're at a place where they're going to have to say no to someone that they love, and the no is going to be the right thing, and the no is going to be the loving thing, and the person being told no is not going to understand any of that, and it's going to be a little bit of a fight, and it's all about me loving you, so, you know. And the only thing I can do is invite you to patience. It's still right to say no. We have to say no. And it goes back to a child does not learn except sometimes through their own mistakes. And some mistakes are too bad to make. We cannot let them make some mistakes. And so we're going to have to say no. And they're going to have to trust us when we say no. And they may fight with us, but they're going to have to trust us enough to obey. And how will they ever trust us except that we have been actively and successfully seeking their benefit consistently? And at a certain point, they will learn to trust us. And they will have the small little excursions away from obedience where they will learn. Not necessarily from your punishment. Sometimes it will be from your punishment, but sometimes, you know, they do the thing that you said do not do, and they will do that thing, and they will get bit on the behind, and they will learn, oh, she wasn't kidding when she said that this wasn't the right thing to do, okay? You know, if they have enough circumstances like that, enough little ventures into the realm of freedom where they recognize that your advice was actually for their welfare, you know, and if you can have that happen enough such they trust you in their teens. If they do not trust you by then, what's the trouble? Oh, all of a sudden they become open to wild possibilities, you know? So we really have to have these things firmly in place. So this obedience in parenting that the scriptures require of the child place expectations upon us to be honorable, to be trustworthy, such that when they obey us, it will actually be for their benefit. And there are going to be moments when we do not know. And what should we do when we do not know? Pray is not a bad one, you know. I don't see, ask, exactly. I see no problem in admitting that you do not know. It's one of those things. I will go to teach a course on the Gospel of Matthew, Mark, or Luke, or John to a group of priests, and I will speak at them for about 6 hours a day for 5 days. All right? And it's funny, the moment when they begin to take me most seriously is not the moment when I demonstrate my brilliance and how much I know. It's the moment someone asks me a question that I do not know, and I respond by saying, you know, I don't know the answer to that. You know, and it's funny because you'd say, well, at that moment, you have just revealed yourself as a fraud, haven't you? You know, well, no, that's not it at all. What actually happens at that moment is that they recognize that everything else that I've said, yeah, I'm relatively confident in that, such that I don't have any trouble in telling you when I don't know that thing, you know? And curiously, that's the moment when they begin to trust when I do speak. The older your child is, the more effective this is. It's not something to do when they're too young. But to admit at a certain point, I don't know, but let's look at this together from every angle, you know? Especially as they get a little older. For you to say that you do not know is not an expression of failure. It's an expression of wisdom. Okay? It is folly to pretend to know what you do not know. And children will learn to not trust us when we act on ignorance. All right? Now, so when you do not know, pray was one of the answers. That's a good one. Admitting that you do not know at the age-appropriate time, that's another one. You know, I always suggest ask your parents. You know, ask grandma, ask grandpa. It is entirely possible that they have a better idea than you do. Do parents bring their kids into me? And yeah, sometimes, and sometimes I'm successful. Sometimes I'm not sure that I am. Do parents take their children to school counselors? I highly recommend it when you do not know. I highly recommend it. Now, do you have to be very careful about which counselors your children see? Yes. And there are some questions where you have to be more engaged in it than others, and you have to perhaps find Christian counseling as opposed to school counseling, depending on what the issue is. There are some moral issues where, I'm sorry, we cannot simply entrust them to school counselors. Some of the advice that would be given would be morally questionable from a Catholic perspective. Okay, at that point, a Christian counselor might be advisable. All right. When you don't know, admit it. And find someone who has the best chance of being able to provide something. And you will still be acting honorably. You'll still be acting honorably. Okay? So, let's move on to the most dysfunctional family of the New Testament. Okay? Parents struggle, children will struggle, and, you know, often enough there's going to be real failure. And Jesus heads right into the waters of this on a parable of the correct response to massive failure on the one hand and self-pitying self-righteousness on the other, okay? So the parable I'm talking about, of course, is... Okay, now, what happened? There we go. All right. Now, is this actually a parable about the prodigal son? I mean, if you look it up in your Bible, that will be the heading. Is it the right heading? I'd like to question that heading. Really, fundamentally, the story is not about the son. It is about the father. Okay? So, in this case, we're going to walk through this story analyzing how the sons are behaving. But really, the focus needs to be for us, especially in a parenting situation, on the father. Okay? So, a better name for the story might be the parent who forgives the child that runs away, or the child who made the right decision to return home. But I think the parable of the loving and forgiving parent is probably the best name that I can think of. But it begins in Luke 15, 10. In just the same way, I tell you, there will be rejoicing among the angels of God over one sinner who repents. So he said, a man had two sons. And the younger son said to his father, Father, give me a share of your estate that should come to me. Now, that's a nice way of saying, drop dead dad. Inconveniently, Dad, you're still alive. The more convenient thing would be if you were dead and I had simply inherited my portion, okay? But you're not dead, and he's not. But I'm not willing to wait, okay? Talk about an affront. Talk about anguish and pain. I mean, I don't know what the father felt at that moment. So the father divided the property between them. And after a few days, the younger son collected all of his belongings and set off to a distant country where he squandered his inheritance on a life of dissipation. When he had freely spent everything, a severe famine struck that country, and he found himself in dire need. So he hired himself out to one of the local citizens who sent him to his farm to tend the swine. And he longed to fill his hunger with the pods in which the swine were fed. But nobody gave him any. Now, this story is worse than it seems to us. There is no social security in this world. All you have is family. That's it. In an insecure world, when all you have is family and you've just told your father to drop dead, and you've taken what you've received from your father, and you've wasted it. This is not simply incomparable stupidity, but it is a defiance of every value of the world where there is no other buffer to have taken this thing and have wasted it in this way. And he lost more than his money. He lost his family and his home. He's off in a distant country. He lost his security. Here we are, there's a famine, and he has nothing, and he's feeding pigs. He's lost his religion. He's feeding unclean animals. He's lost his connections to his fellow Jews. He's hired to someone of that country, okay? So he's lost everything. So when not only when the son admits that he is dying, I am dying here, but it's also recognized by the father, because remember, what's the father going to say about him? My son was, but is now alive. I mean, he really was. I mean, so now we have our own modern equivalents to this story. We do. We have children who lose themselves to drugs and alcohol, don't we? Yeah. In spite of all of our warnings. We have children who abandon their faith, don't we? Yeah. And go wandering after lesser religious experiences or no faith at all. We have children who are convinced of their own entitlement, who fail in all of their key relationships, multiply divorcing, uninvolved in the life of their children, involved in multiple meaningless sexual relationships. We have children who have their own modern equivalents of what this young man did. And I'm going to place a bet that everyone in the room knows somebody. It's entirely possible that there are people in the world who at various different points in their life was this body, you know? He says, coming to, the scriptures say in verse 17, coming to his senses, he thought, how many of my father's hired workers have more than enough food to eat, but here I am dying from hunger. I shall get up and go to my father, and I shall say to him. Now, what's his motive here? It's survival. Is it other interested? Does he ever say in his mind or heart that he is sorry? No, please notice, he does not. What he says here is, I shall get up, go to my father, and I shall say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I no longer deserve to be called your son. Treat me as you would one of your hired workers. At no point in here does he say, I am aware that I hurt you. I am aware that what I have done must have appalled you. I am aware that you have been grieving for me ever since then. At no point does he say any of these things, and worst of all, at no point here does he say, I am sorry. So this is the least possible contrition out there. All right. It is self-motivated. He's coming home, and he's going to mooch off Dad again. All right. So he got up, went back to his father. While he was still a long way off, his father caught sight of him, spat, and said, he is no son of mine. The word of the Lord? No. 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 Father caught sight of him and was filled with compassion. He ran to his son. He ran to his son. He ran to his son. He ran to his son and embraced him and kissed him. That's completely lacking in dignity. After what his son did to him and his life's labors and his very life itself, completely lacking in dignity, was it the right thing to do? Have you been hurt like that? Have family members ever done that to you? You know, strangers can tell you to drop dead, and what do? You know, we can cope because we really don't care, you know. It's their family members. It's our friends who destroy us emotionally. So, when this story is told about a father and a son, it's to make it absolutely clear to us that when the one who is most able to destroy us emotionally does so, and when they come back to us, crawling on their hands and knees, and we know that they're going to try to use us again, that the right response is completely lacking in dignity. Completely lacking in dignity. It has nothing about the I told you so. Notice that there's no I told you so here. Now, why does the Father do this? Is he an enabler? There's